We made this.
Hi, this is Bill Smitrovich, Lieutenant Bob Bletcher on Millennium. And you're listening to The Time Is Now.
Hello and welcome to The Time Is Now, Soylent Green is People. This is Kurt North, and today I have with me John Kenneth Muir, contributor to the Back to Frank Black book. John Kenneth Muir, how are you doing today?
I am doing well, Kurt. Thank you so much for having me on.
It's a pleasure to have you back on. You were on the primer episode at the very beginning of this journey, and it was a delight to speak to you then, and it's good to get you on an episode as well. So
I am delighted to be back and delighted to be talking about a second season episode too.
It'll be interesting to see where this one lies, really, because it is an interesting, quite esoteric episode, so it'll be interesting to see what we come up with during the next hour or so. So what we are going to discuss today is season 2, episode 2, which was Beware of the Dog. The episode was written by Glenn Morgan and James Wong, and it was directed by Alan Coulter, and it sees Frank arriving in Bucksnort, where we find out all is not well with the balance of good and evil. Now, as we do every week, John, we rate these episodes out of 10 and also have a look at IMDb. What would you rate this episode out of 10? And before we delve into the episode itself, what are your general thoughts on Beware of the Dog?
You know, it's one that I've always liked, and then I revisited it, in preparation for this episode. I was surprised maybe that I didn't like it quite as much as some of the others that I have revisited. It's still fairly young in the... after sort of the second season reimagination of what Millennium is supposed to be. And there are so many elements of it that I really like, but I also feel that there's a lot of sort of pushing of like the new format, like a sort of like a lot of overlay of it that maybe actually works against some of the deeper ideas. And today, looking at it in 2019, I mean, I have to wonder a little bit too about what it ultimately is trying to say and whether that message is a little confused or not at the end. So this is one that I used to really, really like. And then rewatching it, I'm surprised I didn't like it quite as much. I hate to say that because I'm such a Millennium fan.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think I would maybe land this somewhere at a 7.
Right. Okay. Well, I would go slightly higher, 7.5. But I have a thing with this episode. I have to be in the right mood to watch it. It's not an episode that I would go and straight away rewatch, but if I'm in a particular mood, I will go back to it. I see what you're saying about themes, and I think we'll get into the theme of good and evil and how that the outside world takes over the town in some ways during the episode that we delve into deeper. IMDb rates this at 7.5 out of 230 votes, which places it about 6th from bottom of the second season. Would you think that'll probably be about right then? Would you rate it slightly higher than that?
I think that probably is about right. I mean, again, this is one that it's funny because Millennium, it's such a colorful show, visually, thematically. And so I can summon images from this episode right out, you know, without having watched it in years. It's one I remember, but then actually going back and experiencing it all, I thought, well, you know, there are a lot of memorable things here. There's a lot of things for us to talk about, but this is the first time I've watched it. I thought, wow, this really doesn't come together as well as I remember it or as well as I would like it to.
What were the sort of outlying facts or that kind of stuck out to you that didn't really connect with you this time?
Well, it struck me as watching it right out the gate that you could turn on Beware of the Dog, and you, in your first 5 minutes, you don't know if you're in the X-Files or Millennium. Mm. The teaser, while not bad, you know, it's a couple in their RV, you know, basically pulling into this town and then being set upon by dogs. It feels very X-Files. You know, you've got the Carpenters tune close to you playing. I realized, okay, the things that made Millennium distinct in the first season, you know, and very much its own vision, those edges have been smoothed out a little bit, and we could be in an X-Files here. This could clearly be an X-File. Like, and the scene that you imagine after this, you know, it could very well be Mulder and Scully arriving on the scene instead of Frank. And I thought, oh, you know, it doesn't make it bad per se, but it does seem an unfortunate, like I said, smoothing down of the edges of Millennium to do something that, listen, I love horror. I love horror. This is clearly a horror opening, but it feels like a little less provocative than what we're used to in Millennium. Like, let's play. It works as montage. We've got the Carpenter's song. We've got the colorful location. We've got the animal attack. It's not bad as horror, but it, like, as far as like social commentary and stuff like that, it's sort of very unprovocative and very generic. That's why I said you could be in an X-Files or Millennium at this point. You know, I didn't like that. Just like I didn't really particularly like the, I guess it was Bobby Darin music, which becomes a thing in the second season. Like, they're trying real hard to push this second season format. It's like, bam, we're going to hit you with the Bobby Darin music too. It's like, we're rewriting who Frank Black is. And they're hitting that a little hard for my taste with the kind of generic opening with a pop song, a pretty much horror trope, like, you know, evil dogs. Like, there's a 70s movie called The Pack with like dogs attacking people. There, you know, there was one in the 2000s too called The Breed. I mean, you know, it's kind of generic. It's kind of generic. And then we move into the story and we're like pushing this new idea of who Frank Black is, that he listens to this music when we never heard him listen to this on any trip he's ever taken before, ever, in the first season.
All of a sudden he has a love for Bobby Darin. It just came out of nowhere.
right. And I'm thinking, okay, you know, this is maybe you said esoteric before. Maybe this is an esoteric connection, but you know, I pay a lot of attention to shows that are sort of very brilliant and idiosyncratic in their first season and then get a makeover in their second season where they're trying to make it more mainstream and popular. The science fiction series Space 1999 was very much that way. And you can in like the first season was very brilliant, very visual. And the second season, they tried to make it a lot more like Star Trek. And I think Millennium a little bit this episode. I mean, I love the second season, but I think this episode is a little problematic because you can see those gears pressing so hard. Like, this is the new Millennium. This is the new Millennium. You know, Frank Black loves Bobby Darin, even though he's gone on so many trips before and you've never heard him listen to Bobby Darin. And look at this very sort of tongue-in-cheek but also horror kind of fun opening sequence instead of something that's like going to genuinely disturb you and unnerve you and make you think about where we are as society. So like right off the bat this time, I felt like I could see the sausage making. I could see the gears churning under the surface to try to basically rewrite the format of Millennium into this new format.
Yeah, I mean, I said last week in the beginning and the end, it was like a checklist of how many things can we tick off to say that we've done. that kind of either reset the ballpark or actually seen things in for the season. To continue that on, you mentioned Bobby Darin there, that, you know, that's almost like a tick I've got, right, we're doing that now. You mentioned about the music as well at the beginning of the Carpenters song there. Are you a fan of that kind of trope that Morgan and Wong particularly like, in obviously the likes of Home and this one and other episodes later on in the season as well, with like in the year 2525 and Horse with No Name. Are you a fan of that kind of trope that they use?
I do like when they find sort of a pop song and then have a visual montage to it and you're asked to sort of ironically appreciate it. I do think it works. I do think that became sort of a staple of the X-Files. I think that if you look at episodes like the Stephen King one, Shingo, where they did like the Hokey Pokey and the doll, and you look at how they do it, that became, and Home, one with the song Wonderful, I think that became a very X-Files thing. I mean, right up into the recent reboot where they used Downtown for one of the episodes. Like, to me, that's something that really sort of works brilliantly with the X-Files. I think the one you mentioned that comes up in the end of the second season with Laura Means. I think that's different. To me, I do love that, but to me, I don't paint that with this one, because to me, that is about her mental state and the sheer like duration of that and the madness. It's like, to me, there is something very sort of deep, and you know that's where that kind of montage works brilliantly. To me, this just feels very like X-Files light. I don't think there's a deeper character connection as we have there in the one you mentioned. I love it there. I mean, I think it can work in Millennium under the right circumstances, and I think that was one. But here, to me, it just feels like this was piped in right from, you know, it's an X-Files opening. Like I said, if you were to put somebody down who has a passing familiarity with the X-Files and Millennium and just showed them this opening scene, they wouldn't know which theme song was going to follow next, whether it was going to be the X-Files or Millennium, because it's so generic. You know, the part close to you, I mean, okay. I mean, it's a fun song to make fun of. It's always fun to make fun of the Carpenters. It's kind of an easy shot, you know, and I don't know that it relates that well to the dog attack, you know, so it's like, it's just very generic. Whereas like the downtown one in the X-Files is brilliant. So is Wonderful. I'm thinking, and again, Hokey Pokey, how that works with the doll and movement. And like, there are far better examples of this probably in both X-Files and Millennium, where you're able to sort of draw more ironic, funny, or even frightening parallels. This just feels like woefully generic to me. Like, again, you don't know which show you're in for the first 5 minutes.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It definitely does feel like an X-File opening. And you've only got to look at, I don't know if it's next episode or a couple of episodes time, with Sense and Anti-Sense, which is very X-Files light as well. And I don't know how much of that would have been a producer from the producers or from up above that may have been saying we need to get the audience back. They've already said that, you know, they wanted 98% less serial killers. Are they trying to get with the second episode, get that audience in or not, potentially? That's certainly something to bear in mind as well.
Right. You know, to me, it's like, you know, and I think I said it in the Back to Frank Black book, the Millennium in the first year, the serial killers of the week. I know that was tiresome. And even I had mentioned that at the time, like, oh my gosh, it's a different serial killer every week. But if you look closer, it's more like sort of a deranged mind every week. And, yeah. And the comparison I ultimately made was, it's like, Planet of the Week on Star Trek. They go to a different planet. You encounter a different sort of person with a different kind of pathology in Millennium. So imagine then to say, I want 98% less planets on Star Trek. Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, I get it. I get it. But, you know, this is where we talk. You do something like that and you're fundamentally altering the identity of the series. And I mean, obviously maybe that was the point, to fundamentally alter it. But it makes the connect between two seasons a lot harder to make.
I can't remember from the primer episode which season you said was your favorite, but how do you view season two overall? I mean, this was obviously just the very beginnings of it. Do you think that it really takes off as you get further into the season? Is any
I do. Absolutely. I mean, I don't want, you know, my comments regarding this episode to suggest that I don't enjoy or appreciate the artistic value or entertainment value of Millennium season two. I do think, there are some things that I like very much coming up, like in the episode Monster, there's a monologue at the end that is, you know, totally Frank Black.
And yeah.
I even love the sort of comedic episodes, the Scientology episode. So I think season two ultimately works. But I think that there are some episodes, the one you mentioned, Sense and Anti-Sense, maybe it's Single Blade of Grass, and I think to some extent Beware of the Dog, where we are – it knows what it doesn't want to be, but the show doesn't yet know what it is supposed to be. It knows what it wants to avoid, but it doesn't quite know what it is supposed to include. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a fair comment, yeah.
And I think that's where we are with some of these episodes. I mean, I think they find it. I think that they do find it. And I think you can even sort of interpret Beware of the Dog in terms of the animal attack thing. In terms of, you know, what I saw as far as like animal symbols throughout this season. Mm. I think it can play there. But I mean, you have to kind of be on a real sort of meta streak to pull all that together.
Yeah.
Like if I sat down, I just watched this and I hadn't, and I was watching the second season, I'd be like, what was that? If I didn't watch all of Millennium and then go back and try to contextualize this, if just that sort of like the first time this aired, I watched this and I say, what the hell was that?
You mentioned animal symbolism there. Now that's something that you wrote in the book. Can you give us a bit more detail on what your viewpoint is, particularly with Beware of the Dog? But there's obviously things like in, let's say, Single Blade of Grass, there's episodes like Owls and Roosters, for example,
right,
that animal symbology is used quite a lot. And you've wrote about that. Can you just give us a brief idea of what that entails in your eyes?
Well, right. The first season of Millennium kind of had its own internal sort of thematic consistency, and it didn't involve that. I think it was much more about like examples like for Frank Black to like run across and learn about and like decide where he stood on them. The second season, I mean, very interestingly, and I think Beware of the Dog does set this out a little bit. I mean, I do think we're talking about the series expands, and what it explores here isn't so much it's so hard to say this, some of this stuff, but like the first season, like they're all of these kind of sick, deranged people, and they're like going off as if like they're symptoms of a deranged society on its last legs. We're rocketing towards an apocalypse, right? But we're not seeing that like on this like global natural scheme. We're seeing it like in like this interpersonal destruction, these deranged people. Like, why are we seeing them everywhere now? And that's a symptom of the end. Now, when we move to the second season, we move more towards this idea of like all of these other cultural ideas of like the end of the world, doomsday, right?
Yeah.
And it is more like it's not just people, it's all over the world. So it's like we get these different ideas of doomsday, and I hope this is making sense, but then it's like, so the natural world is represented by like these animals, like and so in A Single Blade of Grass you have like the buffalo, right?
Yeah.
And the animals running through the city, right? Like signs of disorder, like of the natural world upended. You can definitely see that here as well. And there's talk about things are out of balance. And so these dogs are like the sentinels to sort of keep the balance. There's always another dog. It's like the natural world is almost like creating these antibodies to try to maintain the balance of the world, but they can't. And again, maybe it's because people are doing things. Maybe it's because we're just moving towards that time, whatever it is. So, I mean, I do think there is something very intriguing and interesting about that. And I think it's completely valid for a show called Millennium about the end of 1,000 years, the beginning of another 1,000 years, to tread in these doomsday ideas. I do, again, my question in terms of Beware of the Dog is sort of the Michael character and how he is depicted, I feel, and like basically saying you can't live here. that's what ultimately this episode is about, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Okay. And we can go into a little more detail about it. I'll be curious to see how you read that, but like reading it today in 2019, how I read that, I was like, wow, this is like a little bit, I mean, he's played as sort of this effete guy watching musicals. I mean, you don't have to read too much between the lines there. No. And then you don't belong here out in the country with all these sort of, salt of the earth people. You got to go back to the city.
I hadn't read it that way, but I did read into his character that he was that way inclined.
And I found that a little troubling because I've never, ever sensed things like that in the works, in Millennium. But I thought, wow, that's a terrible example to say you don't belong here. You have to leave. And then they just like burn his house. They burn his house and he goes back right to the city where he belongs. And now nature is okay. Again, I don't believe in reading too much into things. It just really struck me this time in the way he's portrayed. There's sort of a I don't want to say homophobic because that's probably too strong, but there seems to be some sort of between the lines commentary here that I find a little unsavory.
Yeah.
I don't know what you think, Kurt. I mean, am I totally off? You tell me. Am I off my rocker?
Well, no. I mean, I didn't see it that way. But as I say, reading into the character when I watched it, he was everything but basically saying he was gay, which is fine. Right. Which is fine in modern day TV for people not to announce that. Whether or not that was by design or not, it could potentially be, I suppose. But I can see exactly the line of thought that you're going down with the. With the "you don't belong here," you know, "this is our town," you know, we look after our own, you know, "what are you doing here?" Kind of right wing protectionism, yeah. That type of thing. I can see that totally.
You know, and then Frank Black to take that line, "you just have to leave." You know, you know, it's like, wow, Frank.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I think we take it. I mean, you know, certainly in America, people have the right to live where they want to live, and it seems very unfortunate to me to say nature as a force disapproves of you and will push you out with these dogs, and you know, and then we burn your house, right?
Yeah.
Because I'm sure a guy like you has insurance. I mean, that's basically what is said.
Yeah. It's rough for him, isn't it? So let's delve deeper into the episode. When we do come out of the credits, we find that the events of last year are playing on both Catherine and Frank's mind. We've kind of half talked about this already, but the resetting of the family dynamic over the season itself presents some new challenges for the writers. And we've got Catherine wanting to sell the house, and Frank still believing in the point of the house. And if we even get like the stilted line of, you know, "we're not exactly racking the codec moments up," which I thought was an interesting comment considering the previous episode.
Right. Right, yeah. Good catch, yeah.
What did you think of that scene and the idea of the Yellow House over the course of season one, moving into season two, and obviously the dissolution of the marriage and the things that Frank has gone through? And it's pretty much, I think Darren Mooney has said this, and it's obvious that this is the case, that Frank's being put on almost a hero's journey through the season. But what did you think of the separation of Catherine and their storyline moving forward?
The Yellow House being, you know, the main symbol really of Millennium, and being able to interpret it and reinterpret it through different seasons, I think one of the really prime joys of this show to see, you know, it's an island. In the first season, it's a paradise for them. It's the one ray of yellow sunshine in their lives. And so if it's paradise, then what the second season is paradise lost for Frank, certainly. And, you know, the beginning of his heroic journey to, you know, reclaim the family and his house. I think that's a completely valid approach. I think that's great. I think it's a great way to reinterpret the meaning of the Yellow House. I do feel that this journey, while being completely valid for Frank, doesn't do anything for Catherine as a character. And I mean, I think it's clear why by the next season, it's like she had to be out. I mean, we're all invested in Frank. We all saw him risk everything to save his family in the previous episode. May he have been too violent considering what is going on? Of course, but what was he doing? He was trying to save his family. So for her to turn around and be like, "I don't know you anymore," you know, I don't think it does her character any favors. I think it's a huge misstep for her character, and it's all but the death knell for her, because once she makes that, it's like, really? This is someone who put their life on the line for you, and now you're so upset that you're going to like dissolve the very thing he was fighting for and saved you for? I mean, that's just my take on it. But I'll tell you, when we saw this, my wife and I were like, wow, you know, wow, you're harsh. You know, he's just been through a lot to save your life and save your daughter's life, really. And this is your response. It's very nebulous. It's like, again, I feel like I see the gears grinding here. It's like Catherine must reject Frank so that they're not in the Yellow House and he can go on this other journey. I mean, it's very transparent to me, like what they're doing. Even though I think that's a valid way to take, I don't think the execution of it is particularly good. I think those scenes are very stilted and awkward because I don't think they come from an honest or organic place. And I don't feel like the actors feel like even came from an organic or honest place. we have decided you have to be separated this season for this season to work. So you will now be separated, even though it makes no sense given what we know of your relationship so far.
Because Catherine is meant to be the second lead, and she never attains that apart from two or three episodes.
Right.
And it just they never feel like I never feel that they've done particularly well with it. I think they do okay in season two to a degree in certain episodes and certain scenes, but the overall story I think suffers. I don't know what you think on that, but
I mean, I think she was playing a role that I mean, she's a very good actress and an interesting character, but like the character becomes basically impossible to play as she had played it, because before she'd been very sort of sympathetic and supportive. She was there for Frank. She was very loving and protective. And now there's really no reason why they couldn't work this out without separating what we know of her. I mean, she's a therapist, for God's sake. You think she would, right? but no, she takes this radical step, but they also don't want you to like blatantly dislike her. So these scenes are like very generic, and you don't really understand like what's the issue. You both seem very reasonable. You're both very verbal people, you know, as far as being able to communicate.
Yeah.
Feeling so what the hell is going on, right? It's clear that they've decided you all must be separated so that whatever the arc of the season is, you know, you can have the reconciliation or you can have whatever the plan is. But to me, it just doesn't work, and it sabotages her character, because who is Catherine after this?
Yeah, she's more of an ideal. It's Frank's ideal, isn't it, Ramon, than anything
right.
else?
Yeah,
something to attain.
Right. So she it's like that. She becomes that. She becomes this abstract thing like the Yellow House. But you can't have a scene with a human being like sort of as an abstract symbol, right? I mean, you know, you have to understand why they're doing things, where they're coming from, and to me, these scenes are so stilted. I don't know if you used that word. I think you did. There's something not right in the performance of these scenes and the conception of these scenes. Again, it's like we're seeing this really like top down. Here we are recreating Millennium in our image, and this is how it's going to be. You're not going to have the Yellow House as the regular setting. You're not going to have the marriage as the backdrop. I mean, if that's the way they were going to go, I would say why not kill Catherine in the beginning and the end, right? Because she's now in this sort of neither here in this camp nor here in this camp limbo. We lose all sympathy and identification with her at this point.
Peter is in this episode very briefly, but what he says and does in this episode is quite telling, again, with retooling Millennium, because he calls Frank the minute he logs into the system as if he's been waiting for him for all those hours.
Right.
And it basically says, you know, you know, you need to go to this crime scene. What did you take to Peter in those few scenes, that one scene that we get him in on this particular episode?
Well, I mean, I think it's very interesting, you know, because I do think Millennium fits all together in its three seasons, despite the shifts in format. And I kind of see that as in like Frank becomes entangled with a cult that he doesn't know is a cult in the first season. And he builds friends and connections with people like Peter Watts. And then the second season, it's like the dawning realization that it is a cult as he gets in deeper. And now like Peter is kind of indoctrinating him. And then the third season, it's like he realizes he was sort of on the borderline of a cult and that it's a very negative influence. And then Peter sort of becomes his enemy. I mean, I think you can, there is a way through to read it that way.
Yeah.
So yes, Peter Watts is incredibly different in this episode than we've seen him before. You're right. It's like he's surveilling Frank and then just gives him very generic, like, you have to go here. You know, no, we never saw him in that mode in the first season. I mean, he was somebody, you know, Frank was teamed with a lot of different people in season one, but Peter Watts was the one you always wanted to see him with because they kind of had this nice professional but also friendly working relationship. There wasn't like a power dynamic between them. And what we asserted here is a power dynamic where Peter is now asserting basically control over Frank as Frank becomes a, you know, candidate for being in the Millennium Group, which, you know, is being reparsed as a cult at this point. So I think if you look at it that way, it's okay. Again, I was just struck watching it this time that if you sort of watched Millennium the first season and then like you were just tuning in, you know, for the season and you see it, you're like, what? Right? Yeah. What's going on? You know, Peter? Right? Well, you know, and why don't you go with him? You know, because you always went out together, and you know, so there's a different power dynamic in their relationship now, which I do think works ultimately for the season. And I don't think I find it as disturbing as the shift in Catherine, because I feel like if we look at that arc that I mentioned, if we want to try to look at Millennium as that kind of arc through three different lenses, first season, yeah, second season, third season, I think it works. So I think this new reading of Peter as being somebody who is indoctrinated in the group and is now carrying the group's water to get Frank in, I think it works. But again, it's a bit of a shock to the system. Whereas the Catherine thing, I think they didn't know what the heck to do with Catherine. And so she's just in this weird nebula. I think they did know what to do with Peter, and they're doing it. You know, yeah, it's still a shock to the system, but it's like there is a plan. Like I don't feel the plan with Catherine, I guess, by contrast.
Yeah, because you get in the, again, going back to the beginning and the end from last week, that a part of the checklist was the fact that, you know, we get the hero welcome in the airport with Millennium Group. All of a sudden they become a character in themselves in some ways. There's a big hero shot. Adam Chamberlain had the script and it was saying, you know, it does say hero walkthrough. So the retooling that, and obviously Peter Watts was part of that process. And then in the episode itself, Frank finds out that they're holding information back from him.
Right.
So it's moving on from that as well. So there's that element too, that Peter's becoming more of, as you say, the more power dynamic, the fact that he's pretty much ordering Frank to go. What do you think of Frank's retort to Peter in that, though? Because there was a bit of restraint from Frank as well, because he was kind of getting frustrated, and you could see that starting to bubble to the surface, and obviously that'll come into play in future episodes.
You know, it's very interesting, because there were a couple of points in this episode where I felt Frank was, I'm trying to think of the right word, sharper or more sarcastic than, or impatient than we usually see Frank. You know, and I have to take responsibility for my own interpretation. You know, sort of how I read Frank is like the center that holds. He is, you know, the advice that Chris Carr gave him, don't use your hands a lot, things like that. He is like the stable center. And like the rest of he's like at the eye of the tornado, right?
Yeah.
You know, and he's stable, and he's judicious, and he's balanced. And we do know the things that set him off when in Lamentation, the fear when he knows that Lucy Butler has been in his house, and he has to, you know, sort of leap into action and get home because his family's in danger. I mean, we know there are triggers. The same thing beginning and the end, his family's in danger. That's the trigger that moves him off of this compass point of being very judicious, calm. I mean, he's faced in the first season with, you know, people who don't like him, don't trust him, are like emotional basket cases, but he's always the calm in the storm, right?
Mm, yeah.
And so there are a couple times in this episode where he lets off a sort of, you know, sarcastic kind of thing or a sharp retort. And I think it's not the trigger we know, which is his family. It seems to me like a subtle rewriting of the character to make him possibly more appealing, to show that he, you know, but personally, I don't find it that way. What I find appealing about him, it's like he is this calm person. He doesn't rise to people's bait. I mean, if you look at the first season, there's so many opportunities where people try to diminish him, knock him off his game, and he never takes the bait. He never comes off his calm, judicious center. So it's like, you know, granted, things are happening in his life. His wife is leaving him. He's losing his house. So, okay, maybe that's why he's like that in this episode. But again, I feel like it's they're chipping away at who he was, so that he'll be who they want him to be. And by they, I mean the producers, the writers, whoever, who's ever running the show here. So, I mean, my first instinct to say I don't really like it, because to me, the magic of Millennium is that Lance Henriks performance. And, you know, when you get to Monster, that episode, and Lance Henriksen has that impact.
Yeah, in the jail scene.
Yeah, the big impassioned monologue where he talks about how he sees people. Everybody was that child at some point, you know, and he's like, to me, that is who Frank Black is. And even though that's impassioned, it's like a statement of identity. He's under like pressure, and under that pressure, he has this impassioned moment, but it's like the key to his philosophy. And if you read all three seasons, it's like, well, yeah, you know, I don't know. I don't know. So for me, again, that's just my interpretation, and I take responsibility for it. But that's how I feel about it. I don't like to, you know, I don't like to think of him as I don't need him to be a vehicle for my frustration or whatever. I like seeing him resist the impulse to be angry, to be frustrated. I think that's a far more powerful example. I mean, if you're doing a show about, you know, people on the end of the world and being overcome by irrationality and their emotions and things like that, then the antidote to that, you know, who cares? Frank cares. That's it. You know, Frank cares, and he's there and he's calm and he sees all of those horrible things in the world, but he's going to face them with that sort of grounding. And so it's like, I don't really want to see him off his grounding, I guess.
We get the introduction of Michael Beebs, and that leads me to think about the themes of this episode. We kind of touched upon it with the Flaming House, and we can talk about that a little bit now as well. But and the way that I see Frank's life is out of balance as well. So it's kind of in keeping with the theme of the episode. So you've got, you know, the good or evil, that the town folk believe that by moving within the town limits that the outside world hasn't invaded them as such, and that the boundary is kind of like, you know, kind of what we were saying before. It's almost like a protectionism that, you know, they're escaping the evil that's outside, but, you know, the evil is starting to creep in with Michael being introduced and him building that house. And obviously Frank is currently, his life is out of balance. He's seen the gift is giving him personal flashes rather than anything else. And obviously we get the old man saying that it's going to come back, it's come back differently. And I think Glenn Morgan had said that he wanted the gift to be more abstract or more ethereal in some ways, that he would that Frank would have to decipher all that. So what did you think of the general overall theme of this episode of good and evil and the balance and the interruption of balance?
I think it's a great theme. I think it's a wonderful theme for Millennium to cover, because, I mean, you know, how can I say this? But I mean, I think that we, you know, I think all of us feel, maybe not all of us, but the majority of people like living now, you know, worry about that balance. It's like a balance has been sort of one way, and, you know, but then you start to feel the balance slipping. I mean, you know, I don't want to put too fine a point on it with our politics now, since we're 20, you know, odd years away from Millennium. But I mean, you know, when you see something like white supremacy and like even Nazism, like coming into the mainstream, and people saying, you know, there's fine people on that side, and children being put in cages and not even being given the dignity of a toothbrush, being ripped from their parents, you wonder about the balance. What is the balance between good and evil, and has it crossed over? Now, here's the thing, and it's what makes Millennium so brilliant, is I think Millennium also raises the idea that sort of everybody feels like in their lifetime the balance goes awry, especially as you get older. You know, we romanticize the past and worry about the future. And I mean, I think that kind of anticipatory anxiety is a crucial piece of Millennium's equation. So, yeah, someone could say to me, you know, listen, my son doesn't look at the world that way, and he's 12. I mean, I look at it that way because I have an idea of context and history and stuff like that. But he's having a happy childhood because that's the world we make around him, right? You know?
Yeah.
So it's like, as you get older, you think it's the end of the world. Everything's going to crap. You know, the balance is out of whack. But for him, he's happy, and I'm glad, and I hope all children feel that way. But the issue, of course, is that. I mean, that's the issue we're always facing as human beings. Like, what is the balance of good and evil in the world? How do we gauge that? And I think that that's a wonderful theme for Millennium to tackle. And I think that is the theme of the season. Are we slipping out of, you know, what the balance should be? I think where Beware of the Dog becomes problematic for me is not that theme, which I like. It's the execution of the theme, and it's not just what I mentioned before, which I think is the how Michael is depicted. I mean, he's depicted in sort of a way that kind of makes him a figure of fun or levity in some sense, which I don't know is the right approach to take with, you know, this how is the balance shifting idea. But like, even the people of Bucksnort, right? I mean, they're weird, right? They're weird and enigmatic. What do they know? What do they not know? They're almost like a hive mind, because like they're all expecting Frank to come. They all think he's the sheriff, but they're weird.
Yeah, it had almost like a Twin Peaks appeal to in some ways.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's like, okay, so this is who the balance is for. Because their town is being overrun, but they're so weird and sort of unnatural. If you think about it, they behave in very unnatural ways. That I'm not sure that like the point really gets across. Like it does feel a little Twin Peaksy, like uncomfortably so for me. It's like,
yeah.
And by that I mean, as a Twin Peaks fan, I think if you look at Twin Peaks from the outside, and you're just sort of watching it as a casual fan, not if you're trying to analyze all the imagery and stuff like that, but if you're just a casual watcher of Twin Peaks, what you think is it's weird just for the sake of being weird, and isn't that kind of funny?
Yeah.
And to me, that's what Beware of the Dog and the people of Bucksnort feel like. It's like there's no real motivating reason. It's just that they're weird just for the sake of being weird.
Yeah, there's no depth, is there? There's no like kind of three-dimensional characterization, any of them or anything like that. So.
Exactly. No depth, no real meaning to them, no real connection to the theme of the episode. So again, this feels very much to me like this new enforced idea of what Millennium is supposed to be. And I say mainstreaming, it's like we're mainstreaming it. We're not really going to make you think of anything too deep. Instead, isn't it funny? Everyone thinks he's the sheriff. Look at that person trying to make a latte with whipped cream and the waitress. You know, it's just weird and kind of silly for the sake of being colorful, but not really meaning anything. And I mean, it pains me to say that, because like those are words I never want to say about Millennium, because
yeah.
I generally don't feel that way about Millennium. So maybe I'm the worst person to be doing this episode about. I'm so sorry.
No, this is it's probably better for it, to be honest.
I don't know. I hope my comments don't catch anybody amiss, because I'm not trying to project them across the season, because I like the second season. I'm just struck, having watched it this time, like how much of this doesn't really work. And even what you said, I do think they make a really clear point of trying to mirror what is happening to Frank with the adventure in Bucksnort, like even to the fact that his dog now, Jordan's dog now doesn't like him.
Yeah.
And to me, this seems very obvious and pat. It's like, It's too clear. It's
yeah.
I don't know. Maybe this episode just can't win for me. But it's like, wow. Like it's too obvious. It's like that connection is too obvious. And again, is it really merited? You know. So what? This dog doesn't like Frank now because what? Are all dogs like doing this? I don't know.
Did you get a vibe off that dog? Off. I can't remember the dog's name now. Yeah. But that there was an element of supernatural in regard to it, that he was going to Bucksnort and the dog was aware of it.
Right. It was like, and it suddenly doesn't like Frank now. And Frank had a talk, and I was like, you know who I am. What are you doing? Right. It's like, so what? So did a message go out to all dogs? That
potentially. That, right? It's a reach.
Right. That nature is now out of balance and Frank is going to be investigating that balance. I mean, what? So like every dog he encounters, but then it's never ever brought up again, ever.
No.
Ever. Right.
Generally, most stories that you'd the takeaway would be, that the characters learn something from it. Now, because we're kind of there anyway, let's just discuss the very end, because it kind of links in what you've just been saying, is that Frank basically ignores his own advice and doesn't put the house up for sale. How did you think that landed? Because in one scene, literally just before it, he's burning a house down and walking out of that house, and then the other one is saying, "No, I'm not listening to myself. I'm going to keep this dream alive." What did you think of that?
Well, I mean, I think you just said it, Kurt. So you know, right? I'm sorry. He was fully on board rebalancing nature at the expense of somebody else, like literally burning the house down,
yeah.
Right? But then in the next scene saying, no, I'm not going to burn my house down. I'm going to save my house, even though things might be out of balance for me. So what are we to make of that? To me, that's the landing doesn't get stuck here. They don't stick the landing on this, because it's like, okay, for our main character, we're supposed to have sympathy, right? And say, no, keep the house, Frank. That's, that's what can still be. That's your journey to come back to it. But But we're also asked, you know, bafflingly, to say, Michael, your journey doesn't matter. Your journey was that people laughed at you and didn't like you in Seattle or wherever you lived. I forget where, Portland, whatever it was. So you found a spot where you thought you could live, and you made a life here, and you didn't do anything wrong except, I mean, you built a house and you're living in your house and enjoying your house, but you're not supposed to be here because your presence is outside of the natural balance. So you have to go, and all your belongings and your house have to be destroyed. Yeah, to me, there's some kind of – something's not working there. So it doesn't connect or work in a way for me today that holds up.
Yeah, yeah. No, you're making me saying it in a completely different – I'm going to hate this episode by the end of the episode.
I still gave it a 7, right?
Yeah, yeah. We still gave it a 7, 7.5. I might come down to the 7. So I think we'll just – talk generally that there's quite a lot of scenes with the dogs, and just in general with your background in the horror kind of trope, what did you think of all the scenes with Frank and the dogs before we meet the old man? So in general, and how it was filmed, and what did you think of those scenes?
Well, I think Millennium is always beautifully filmed. I mean, you know, its prime appeal to me it has always been, you know, how its visuals are so gorgeous, and then connected to that, which this episode doesn't quite have, is that the visuals really reinforce, mirror, support, ironically contrast with the theme of the episode. I mean, that's the wonderful thing. I have no problem at all with how the dog attacks are depicted. I mean, I think, you know, there are some moments here that feel really, you know, strong horror movie things. You know, I think about Cujo or whatever, where he, you know, where Frank is trying to get into his car and there's the dog sitting on the roof of the car, and is the dog going to move? I mean, to me, that's all absolutely frighteningly effective. I mean, I think too, the teaser is effective too. I mean, the idea of this nice couple, you know, pulling into town, and you know, they're obviously retired, and you know, a sweet, you know, mom and dad, grandma, whatever couple, and then they're set upon by dogs. I mean, yeah, it's absolutely effective. I mean, I don't know that the Carpenter's tune was the right one for the montage, because it you know, kind of makes less of it than maybe what it should be. I mean, I think all the horror stuff works, but the best horror, inevitably, the reason horror is such a powerful medium for ideas is that horror, I always call it the canary in the coal mine. It knows what we're afraid of sort of culturally.
Yeah.
We're still trying to figure it out. And then you go back and look at something like a 10-year-old horror movie, like, oh my God, look, think about what was happening. And look what they're telling us we were scared of then. They're so right, you know?
Yeah.
You know, but that's different than sort of what I call roller coaster horror, which is just like effectively shot horror that the point is just to make you scared. You know, I wouldn't say that this is like the kind of horror like you have in Lamentation, which is like absolutely, you know, it chills your blood, you know? Yeah. You know, it is terrifying. I mean, it's like throat closing, you know, heart pumping terror. This is more like, yeah, this is scary like a roller coaster. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And okay, it's absolutely fine as that. It's very good. Again, my problem, and maybe I'm just a horrible snob, is that it doesn't really tie into anything that I think is enunciated in a deeper thematic cultural way, which really amazingly is what Millennium is often able to do.
Yeah.
You know, and so you could say, well, John, you're judging it on very harsh terms. And, you know, I probably am, but because, you know, Millennium, I mean, it's a masterpiece. I mean, across 3 seasons, in the way it speaks to our culture, the way it uses horror, the way it ties themes together and uses visuals. So it's like, yeah, Millennium often does operate on like this really high plateau. So maybe it's not fair of me, like one time it doesn't, to really rail on it. But I do have to point out that, you know, this isn't one of the better episodes.
He does go, after he does get bit, he gets taken to the clinic or the doctors, and they're all around there. They're all, as you said, mentioned before, they're quite unusual people, and they're talking amongst themselves, and Frank's obviously listening in. And he's getting an inkling about the old man, and that's who he goes to eventually see. What did you think to the old man? And this is kind of the main crux of the episode, where we're learning about the Millennium Group as an event, not necessarily as the group as such, because he's there to learn about the event. And the way that Frank is portrayed and taken to the edge of that circle, and all that scene there when he talks about what lies inside the circle and what lies outside, and in ancient Christian slants, and all that emphasis as well, which was on my checklist actually, with going back to my last episode, was that they seem to go, right, okay, you know, serial killers, spree killers, they're all genetic. This is true evil. So what did you make of that important pivotal scene in this episode?
I actually really liked it. I think the old man is an interesting character. I love to see R.G. Armstrong because, you know, as horror fans know, he's he was like the evil uncle in Friday the 13th, the series in the late 80s. I mean, he's a great character actor. He's been in a lot of horror movies in the 70s and things like that. And he's not playing an evil person here, but it's interesting what he brings into the role. He is sort of a larger than life figure, but I like him and I like how he is portrayed. And I think those aspects of the episode work well enough that I wish they were in a better episode overall, one that cohered a little better, because I think when we get to what is Millennium essentially about, you know, strip it out of all of its, you know, bells and whistles, what we're really talking about is sight. How do we view the world? You know, what is the lens through which we view the world? And, you know, our lens is Frank, and he has unusual sight, right? He's, whether it's this incredible insight or empathy he carries for people, or you say it's psychic. You look at Laura Means and how she views the world through her lens. Even Peter Watts, who doesn't have any sort of exterior, what you might call paranormal or supernatural kind of sight, he has his sight too, which was blazed into him when there was that case with the headless baby in the in the cooler, I guess it was, that was recovered. Like, his identity was forged in that moment, let's say. So those are all examples of sight. We also have in season three, one of my top 10 episode would be Skull and Bones, and there's the guy who keeps – I can't remember his name. Shamefully, I can't remember his name. But he keeps all those journals, and he views the – and, like, he's got, like, hundreds of journals. And he's, like, putting pieces together from what he reads about how he sees the world and what's really the secret of the world. And he can see the Millennium Group through his sight, right?
Yeah.
And what we get from the old man in Beware of the Dog, I mean – I think they literally say it, one job. He says his job is to collect information at one point, and you look at his cabin and his typewriter and their newspaper's headline, and it's almost the same thing. It's this idea that he has a sight that is outside other people's power to see, and that's – he's sort of relating his sight to Frank in this episode. So I really like that. I think it fits in thematically with other episodes we see. It fits in thematically with the idea of sight and sort of individual sight, like how you see the world being like a prime ingredient of Millennium. So I really like this. And again, I'm not here to at all try to like diss the pathway of the second season at all and say that it's not a valid approach they take, because it is. I mean, it's very powerful. I mean, I think the season is great, and you can absolutely make an argument for it. And I think this piece of it in this episode, the old man's piece, is to get us thinking about evil in terms of not the spree killers, not the serial killers, not mental illness, things like that, but this more sort of evil as a force of nature kind of thing, good and evil as a force of nature. And that's the theme that is carried through the season, and I think quite successfully. Again, I think I would like more of the old man in this episode and less of the locals, less of Michael's story, more of the old man, because, you know, there's a lot going on in this episode, but it all doesn't really cohere in a way that I find – particularly pleasant to watch.
Yeah, because we don't get much of the old man moving forward either. We only get to see him briefly in two more episodes, I think.
Right.
So it's which in some ways I kind of like. It's like the whole Alex Krycek thing, when you think Alex Krycek and X-Files was such a big character, but he wasn't in that many, and even the mythology episodes he was in, they often skipped him per story. So, you know, he was in... He wasn't in 731, they say, but he's an Apocrypha. Things like that, so they skipped him. So you think he's in more than he should be. But we only get a handful of scenes with the old man, and I think it's disappointing. But we do, obviously, get more of the mythos as we approach our owls and roosters.
Right.
I like what you say about the idea of it being his kind of view of the world. I think that's really interesting, especially with the choice of having like your hierarchical type of person, because you're not quite sure where he lies within the group. That, you know, he seems to be of it but not in it, you know. And as we learn in later episodes, where they're so entangled in their war that the old man needs to step out from that, and he's actually observing from a different vantage point. So it's a good place to put him. Yeah. And also, you mentioned as well about the letters and things that he's writing to people and getting information back, and the comets come back into this one, which gives a through line for the episode too. So I think that was really well done. And I think, I don't know what your thoughts are on Lance's, but I mean, Lance generally is a great performer. I don't think I've ever seen him take a bad step, but I think he's particularly effective in the scene with the dogs. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think Lance Henriksen is capable of giving anything than, you know, a completely absorbing performance, which makes him, you know, the right person for this role, because, you know, Frank is our point of consistency through three seasons that have some interesting differences, but he's the same. And that's why we can say there's like a Frank Black kind of universe, because he plays it with a consistency and humanity and empathy that is uncommon. And I mean, I think he's excellent here in expressing, the fear. I mean, he's faced with, basically being ripped apart at points, and he's great. I mean, I any of my criticism is sort of never leveled at him. I think he does the best with what he has. And I think a case could be made that's sort of what he's doing here. He's finding those moments that make sense to him here and resonate with him, which is what a good actor does. And responding to them authentically, which I think probably makes this episode a 7 instead of a 5 or a 6.
Yeah, I think you're right with that. I mean, in his book, he says something along the lines of, how can you call the Academy group evil? And he took a while for him to get his headspace around what Blaine was in season 2. So I can say that he struggled a little bit in season 2 to purely understand where Morgan and Wong were taking it. So it's an interesting one. Yeah. They also try, we've mentioned this before, but they're trying to slightly retool his character in some ways and lighten him up a bit. So you've got things like the music with Bobby Darin, but you also get things, just little comments like, you know, that would be a good idea, but your car is parked in the driveway and in the scene in the house, and and my name's not Franklin. You know, those little things that are funny little moments, but they're kind of in there just to lighten things up a little bit more.
Right. You know, I think those kind of moments, I don't have any problem with Frank Black having those moments. I think they do build character. For me, it's like the same idea almost with a character like Spock, who's sort of stoic, because Frank is kind of stoic. He has to be because of what he sees. It's like the fun in breaking down, you can't break down Spock like right out the gate. You have to sort of establish who he is and then break him down. Like, to me, this is like a little early in the season for Frank to be that way. I'd like to like see, you know, where the season is going a little bit, and then say, hey, are there opportunities here to lighten up Frank, to give him sort of a sense of frustration, things like that. I don't know that it's right to come like right back after a summer hiatus and then like have those moments like, my name's not Frank, and things like that. You know, to me that's like a petty thing. It's like, we probably have those thoughts in our head, but like he wouldn't say it, you know. He's not that guy. He's judicious, he's calm, he's reading and taking in everything. So it's like I can see the appeal of like getting under his skin and breaking that down a little bit. But like the second episode out, especially after a first episode that was so shocking and intense, really.
Yeah.
And then like to go 180 degrees and be like, no, we're going to be like needling him a little bit this episode. Keep saying he's the sheriff, and he has to keep insisting he's not the sheriff. You know, this guy's going to keep calling him Franklin, but his name's not Franklin. I mean, it's like, really? I don't know. Maybe in episode 9 or 10 or 14 or 15 of the season, but like right after last week's, you know, yeah. I don't know. I mean, he just went through the ringer. He's just gone through the ringer, and he's got so many really genuine things to be upset about in his life, but this is what's getting to him.
We're at the final act now, so I think we have discussed the house, but I think we can go back into it a little bit. So the final act is fairly typical ending to a story, but what did you make of the actual dog invasion itself and the revelation that Frank gives that basically says there'll always be another dog when there's five dogs. And I've counted every time there's been one on screen now, and there is actually five dogs at all times during the episode, because I wasn't sure. I was like, I'll have to check that. But yeah, so they've got this reoccurring thing that, you know, the balance is back, you know, that one dog dies, but another one takes its place. What did you think of that and the final scene in the house?
To me, again, this really works as horror, and the line, like, there's always another dog, to me, that really works too. I think the idea that, you know, there is always going to be a balance, that nature is always going to push towards balance. I mean, I think that's a powerful idea. I think it works episode wise and season wise. So I like it. I mean, you know, we've talked about what sort of my reservations are, but they don't really have to do with the idea of these dogs as sentinels or, you know, arbiters of balance or the horror aspect as far as like using dogs in that fashion. I mean, I think all of that works, and it makes for like a visually dynamic episode. And as I said before, it's like, I mean, I remember images from this episode to this day from like the first time I watched it, you know, which may in fairness be maybe that's also why it's a seven instead of not a five or a six, you know, because the images are powerful and memorable. I mean, this is like, I think like, you know, an episode you remember from Millennium, just as far as like those images. So they must be doing something right. Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I've watched Beware of the Dog probably, you know, 15 times in 25 years, although not recently, or whatever it is, 20 years. But, you know, as a whole, it didn't work for me, but I can absolutely say I like, before I'd watch it this time, you said, do you want to watch the episode? I said, yes, that's the one with the dog on the roof, the dog standing outside the house. I remember distinctly, you know, being in the log cabin and dogs coming in and, you know, a guy having a gun and trying to shoot, you know, that stuff all works. I mean, that's The Siege. And, you know, The Siege is a great horror movie setting and one that really works well. You think about like people trapped somewhere, an isolated setting, and invaders trying to get in. I mean, that's sort of one of our core fears in our sort of modern technological society, the idea of being, you know, trapped somewhere with sort of like superior forces that like you can't bargain with outside, whether you go to Assault on Precinct 13 or Night of the Living Dead, you know, or even like the movies I mentioned, like The Pack or The Brief, it's the same kind of idea of like, you know, invaders at the door, and you have to find a way out or protect or you know, basically stand your ground and protect your spot. So, I mean, that's a great horror trope, The Siege, and it absolutely does work in Millennium. If you don't, I guess, work overtime to try to connect it to, you know, Michael's story and the fact that he's, you know, basically saying, you're out of balance. Go back to Seattle or Portland or wherever it is you're
right. Yeah, it's definitely that's definitely going to be seared in my mind. Thank you for that, John. It's much appreciated.
Sorry. I've ruined it.
Any final thoughts on the episode that you'd like before we sign off?
You know, I think that Beware of the Dog is interesting it's basically got three or four plot lines going on. And I think whatever failures it has, it works sort of over time to try to connect everything, and the connections are kind of tenuous, and maybe you don't want to connect them that way. You know, you've got your dog story and your weird local story. You've got Frank and Catherine's story in the house. You've got the old man, and then you've got Michael. And I think as we've covered here, a lot of this is very memorable in terms of visuals. But I don't think it all fits together in the way that the creators maybe would have hoped it did. And so I think it's a early run at what they're trying to do with Millennium in the second season. And I don't think they yet have it. So I think, again, I say it's a seven. So, I mean, that's still pretty good in my book. I think enough of it works that it's an episode I could probably rewatch and in a couple of years and be like, yeah, okay, I remember this one, I like it. And it works better the more you know about Millennium. You know, so I'm looking at it sort of from different perspectives here. I think it works better now, except for the sort of possibly homophobic thing in there, which I think would only have been apparent to people who watch it in the last few years, maybe. But I think overall, like, the themes work better now if you know all of Millennium than it would have, like, you just tuned in, what was it, Friday night and like it's your second time in the second season, and this is what comes up, you'd be like, I don't know what show I'm watching. I think that, again, it feels like it owes too much to me to the X-Files. It's very surface and not very deep or profound. I mean, you know, the Carpenters, again, okay, so we're having a little we're having a little joke at the Carpenters' expense. We have this baffling Catherine and Frank scene that doesn't do her any favors. We have the great visual of the dogs and there's some roller coaster horror, but nothing like really connected to anything. And then we have this neat and interesting enigmatic old man who we want to see more of. So
yeah.
And again, I've talked too much, but I mean, I just don't think it all fits together that well.
No, I think that's a good summary. And this is something that I didn't mention earlier on, but you know, in the X-Files, you kind of know what you were getting. So like from season 2 to 3, you know that you're getting a cliffhanger at the end of season 2, and you go into season 3 and you get the conclusion. And then that story will be put back into the sweeps or wherever that may be. And then you would not naturally go into your next episode, which you would know would be typically a Monster of the Week episode.
Right.
Millennium, I think the expectation would be that you would come back after this horrendous story where you save Catherine, and we'd go back to being a serial killer of the week or a dark story about something. But we get, as you mentioned, an X-Files light opening. You even got the dog. It must be Queequeg. it's got to be Queequeg on that, which is very X-Files tropey. And then we get something that's quite well away from what you would expect. So it would throw people off. And I think that you're right in that, you know, it's an early go at trying to retool and rechange and give Millennium a new definition, and does it work? Is it all connected? I mean, I'm not one for like connecting all the dots. You know, as I say, you know, Twin Peaks would never do that. It lets you think about it, but you're right in the there's not enough connected tissue, or there's a few ideas which could have been brought out more. The old man could have been brought out more, and you could have lost other elements that needed to be done. So maybe it needed to do a couple of more drafts potentially,
right?
Just to see where we could go. I think that's my kind of take on it anyway.
No, I agree, Craig. I think you summarized it, you know, brilliantly. You know, and again, I feel bad because I love Millennium.
You gave it a 7 out of 10, and you're sticking to it, so it's good.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, fantastic. Well, thank you very much for coming back on, John. I'm sure we'll speak to you again at some point as we head into season 3. I think isn't probably the next time we'll see you.
Oh, great! Please bring me back for season 3. I'm let's redeem season 3.
Okay, absolutely. We'll get you back in for season 3. Is there anything that you're doing at the moment that you want to promote, or how can people find you online, find your blog, things like that?
Well, I am right now. I have a book coming out in October, which is my third FAQ book. My last one was the X-Files FAQ. This one is Joss Whedon FAQ. And it's not like a biography or anything. It's sort of covering more like the Whedonverse, like Firefly, Buffy, Angel, and looking for the connections there, the Avengers. And for him, the connection is he always has these like sort of disparate teams of people who don't really get along but become this sort of secondary family. So that's sort of what that book is about. I'm working on my fourth big decades book, which is horror films of the 2000s. So I'm looking at like, you know, found footage, torture porn, all the post 9/11 kind of remakes and stuff. Online, my blog is Reflections. It's John Kenneth Muir's Reflections on Film and Cult TV, I guess it is. So I'm so busy with my day job that I don't get to blog nearly as much as I was a couple of years ago. I'm very sad about that. but things are still getting posted. We're coming up on Star Trek week and like a Space 1999 week. I always do in September to celebrate the anniversary of Star Trek. And then the anniversary of Breakaway, Space 1999. So that's where some folks can find me if they're looking.
Yeah, and also you can find me. My Twitter handle is at rmuldrake. It's rmuldrake. And of course, you can find me on the Time Is Now pod as well, as part of this podcast, the part of the We Made This podcast network. Till next time, everyone. This is who we are.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black. who co-produces alongside Kurt North. You can find the show on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod, and on Facebook if you type in The Time Is Now. Plus, we have a Facebook fan group called The Yellow House, full of active Millennium discussion. The Time Is Now is also part of the We Made This podcast network at We Made This Pod, alongside a range of popular culture shows about TV, film, music, and beyond, including our sister show, The X-Cast, an X-Files podcast. For advanced access to The Time Is Now and access to bonus material, consider supporting The X-Cast and We Made This on Patreon at patreon.com/TheXcast. That's patreon.com/TheXcast. You'll find a full range of subscription tiers available. Thanks for listening.